We must recognize that on many problems of great interest, there is no common meeting of minds. There are so many things to learn, and so little is actually known. And yet, from very long ago, men really tried to be thoughtful. And perhaps it is a mistake on our part to assume that all the world's best thinking has been done in recent years. We have a tendency to believe that fact began with the development of a scientific method for the accumulation and evaluation of knowledge. It is true that facts have become very important to us, but so much that we want to know is outside of the boundaries of any machinery that we can set up for the evaluation of human thought. I have always believed that someday we will acknowledge reason to be a valid source of facts. That which is reasonable, truly reasonable, must come very close to the truth itself. And in many areas where facts cannot penetrate, or the factual instincts cannot operate, we have the power of reason. And this has done a great deal to enrich our lives, to make our concepts more noble, our ideals more luminous than they would otherwise be in the face of the available facts. The study of man began when man first began to be aware of himself and others. There are some very interesting forms of knowledge about man preserved by primitive people. We have begun to realize that primitive people could have a valid kind of knowledge, a folk knowledge, something that arises in the inner consciousness of the individual and carries on down through. Nearly all great cultures, civilizations, have produced philosophers of one kind or another. And the philosophers were the scientists of antiquity. Furthermore, there had come down to us a wonderful heritage of ancient legendary, myths of a golden age, fables, folklore. We are not able to fully trace all of these streams of belief, but there is a suspicion that it may sometime be proven that mythology is the history of the prehistoric world of things. That it is only prehistory, veiled in the emotionalizations of later peoples, but still containing much that is valid, much that is essentially true, if we have patience enough and liberality of mind enough to contemplate this rich storehouse without sophistication. The Hindus, Chinese, Egyptians, Greeks, Persians, all developed elaborate theories concerning the origin of man. Even some less cultured nations on our own Western Hemisphere, especially the Maya, the Aztec, and the Inca, gave a lot of thought to this mystery. After all, man lives with himself. He faces himself every day. He learned a little about the lore of his own people. And with the coming of history, a magnificent pageantry was opened to him. We cannot blame him if he speculates. If he tries to think through the mystery of himself, tries to determine in some way where he came from, and why he is here, and where he is going. Nearly all of the older nations of the world assumed that man existed for a very long time. In India, for example, long before the rise of modern science, or the more recent discoveries relating to human remains, the Hindus were already thinking of an earth inhabited by something at least resembling man 20, 30, 50, 100 million years ago. They knew whatever this process was that produced man was not rapid. They realized also that the gradual evolutionary processes which brought man into being were in a way recapitulated by the prenatal cycle in man's present coming into birth. Just as surely as the embryo passes through many stages of development, more or less summarizing the whole evolution of the animal kingdom, so it is evident that man himself came forth a very long time ago. That he was not instantaneously or wonderfully produced. There was not a case of a world without a man, and then marvelously saying, man was there. He did not appear with his girdle of fig leaves, as most often represented in masterpieces of the 15th and 16th centuries. Nor did man arise, as in most of old paintings, clean-shaven and well-groomed. There was something else to this picture. Man had to grow up. Most ancient peoples were convinced that man came out of water. They believed that he some way came out of an ocean, or out of a great depth or deepness. We're beginning to suspect this ourselves, even now. But man, according to the most ancient tradition, was a fish that came forth upon the land. And gradually his gills disappeared. Gradually his fins vanished. Little by little, he assumed the proportions that we now know. Not necessarily because these proportions were destined for him, but because there was a kind of something inside of man that began to fashion instruments for the expression of this inner self. And the shape and appearance of man was due to the urgencies within his own nature, which caused him to externalize the means of accomplishing the purposes that his dawning consciousness began to comprehend. Also, it was assumed that the problem of man had something to do with the animal kingdom. Man is now generally regarded as a mammal. Some rather optimistically hold that he is the highest of the mammals. Others are not so sure. He is certainly the most precocious. But in any way you wish to look at it, there's something that the ancient did not quite understand. It didn't quite meet his thinking. But somewhere, for no reason that anyone could comprehend, one small strain of mammals suddenly began to excel and to specialize until this strain produced man, but left behind man all the rest of the animal world, untouched, perhaps uncontaminated by this process of sudden growth. You can't really answer the question, why did one kind of animal keep on evolving and become man, and another kind of animal did not keep on evolving and become man? We pass over this rather lightly at the moment. It is an inconvenient question. But our ancient friends thought about it. It seemed to them that there had to be a real answer. That there was something about man that was not just animal plus. That some way, man had different endowments so completely that even now, after millions of additional years for evolution have taken place or have passed, these other kingdoms do not seem to be seriously encroaching upon man. Well, they are encroaching in a way, but not by aping him, not by becoming like him. And sometime long ago, a part of animals became man. The miracle has not been repeated. Is there a reason why it has not been repeated? Some of our older thinkers began to contemplate as to what it is in which man differs from the animal. And perhaps a mother knows better than anyone else can, something that happens to the child as yet unborn within her body. The quickening. In some way, this body suddenly comes to life. Something seems to take hold of it. And from that time on, in a strange, wonderful way, that body becomes a living being. And from that time on, that body's destiny is determined by this mysterious, intangible, sudden coming of aliveness, which causes this little inanimate thing to start striking out, preparing itself to be born. The Hindus like to suspect that somewhere in the evolution of the animal kingdom, something happened that resembles a quickening. Suddenly, a part of the animal world was ensouled. Something was bestowed upon it. Something happened. And in this mystery or miracle, a new value was added that was not just the product of evolution. That this something that was added took hold of a potential mental nervous structure and enriched it with a potential not anywhere else found among natural things. This potential immediately began to strike out with its own aliveness. And suddenly, what may have appeared physically to be an animal, suddenly was no longer an animal. The quickening does not necessarily immediately change the appearance of an embryo. But slowly, its destiny is changed. Its destiny is changed by the fact that it is ensouled by something. This was the belief also of some of the early Jewish mystics, the Kabbalists especially. We find traces of it in the apocalyptical Book of Enoch. For in this book, it was declared that at a very remote time, angels, called the sons of God, descended from heaven upon a mighty mountain, and gazing down, looked upon the daughters of men, and came unto them. And from this union was born a race of giants. Perhaps this has an allegory to it that is important. The sons of God, this was a good name for that mysterious thing that quickens. And the daughters of men could be a good name for this body which is quickened. Perhaps, therefore, what the Hindus and the old Kabbalist mystics, the Babylonians and the Assyrians, sought to tell us in their own way was that some kind of superior order of life from another place, from another condition or dimension of being, descended into the bodies of some animals. animals of a kind or type particularly serviceable for this purpose. Nature produced by its striving many kinds of animals. These are described so clearly in the Phoenician history of Synchronython. These monsters of old days gradually vanished away into the void of things. Nature, struggling in the alchemical laboratory of the dawn of time, brought forth creatures, brought forth a world as the home of these creatures. And here, long before the light of our reason was shed upon the world, these creatures, blindly, dumbly, numbly, stumbled through the mysteries of the prehistoric fen. Many of them vanished in the terrible upheavals of volcanic and seismic disturbances. Uncounted millions probably perished in the vast sweep of the glacial periods. But nature, ever trying to create an enduring type, gradually climaxed the animal evolution. By a kind of animal, it may have been not too different from an anthropoid. An animal which had gone as far as beast could go. We see around us today many forms of animals, birds, insects. They're not all alike. They're not all equal as possible potential vehicles for further growth. But there was some time, long ago, among all animals, the best of animals. These are the ones that seem to have been ensouled. These are the ones that seem to have received this quickening. So the ancient Vedas tries to tell us where these beings came from. They did not come from far away. They came some way from the inner structure of nature itself. As we mentioned last week, there was not only a visible world and a subterranean sphere of magnetic and electric forces, but there was an atmosphere, a mysterious band of energy which enclosed the earth itself. A magnetic field or aura extending out from the body of the earth. And this was stratified into various levels of vibration, energy, and quality. And in these various stratifications, according to the ancients, were lives waiting to be born. These lives were born out of the planetary life itself. These lives became embodied as forms developed to receive them. The first of these invisible lives to be informed was the mineral. And as crystallization became more advanced, the surface of the earth becoming capable of sustaining some form of life against the horrible combustions of the period, the pre-formations. As this material substance increased in solidity, a wave of energies, of life principles, were supposed to have ensouled minerals. Now, the peculiar destiny of these ensoulements was that this type of ensoulement had to last for the entire duration of the Earth's existence. Once these souls were locked within the minerals, they could not escape until the mineral kingdom itself was dissolved back into the compounds from which it came. Therefore, sleeping locked within some kind of a strange darkness were orders of life, which, however, had the mysterious power to reveal themselves magnetically, reveal themselves in the strange vibratory patterns of minerals and metals, reveal themselves through the wonderful colorations of metallic and mineral chemistries, and also in the fissions and crystallizations, and the various lines of cleavage, which reveal that minerals, particularly crystals, are all mathematical patterns. Later, from this condition, from the dark earth of the crystal embodiment itself, the material form of things, that gradually began as mosses and lichen, the beginnings of vegetable life. A life which began, according to the Greeks, in decay, in the green scum upon the surface of things. The Platonists believed that water received into itself free spores that floated in space, and that these free lives, captured and drawn within the magnetic field of the earth, fell into water, where a strange decomposition took place, a death. And out of this death and decay, life came. Life as a green scum upon the surface of water. This was the ilium, the ilus, the mysterious source of the family of the Trojans in Greek mythology. When this vegetable kingdom had reached a certain degree of development, lives from the atmosphere of the Earth's outer surface descended into these forms, quickened them, and the true development of vegetable life began. This vegetable life had considerably more freedom of expression than that of the mineral. Yet some of these vegetable forms also lasted a great time, like the sequoia trees and the cryptomeria of Japan, trees that might grow and live and linger for 10,000 years, trees that were old long before the wars of Troy and the fall of the ancient solar race of India. Later, from this same type of continual growth, these plants began to extend further powers. One of the things that seems to have had a strange and little appreciated influence on all this was that plants gradually developed horizontal structures. From the slender, vertical stem of the ancient tree came the far more complicated form of the bush and the shrub, the vine and the tendrils. Perhaps this is why the grape was so highly venerated among ancient peoples, for they believed that when plants developed horizontal spines or horizontal stems, they began to verge toward the animal, because in that kingdom the magnetic field operates through the horizontal spine. But in any event, some plants seemed to have gradually evolved until they could be quickened into animals. And so it went on, until finally some animals reached a point where mysterious beings or entities, held in the outer magnetic atmosphere of the earth, the spores of humanity, were able to take upon themselves these bodies. And in the course of time, the pressure of the peculiar consciousness which we call man broke through. The animal ceased to be like other animals and gradually became lord of the rest, binding to its use those lives not quickened by its own unique mental potential. Various estimates were made as to when this all might have happened. Perhaps the most conservative figures would put it somewhere between 30 and 50 million years ago. It might have been a billion years. Probably not so long, however. But somewhere, when time was right, the unfolding planet, with all that it carried with it, fulfill some destiny locked within its own archetype or purpose, for it began to release in itself, through itself, and from itself, the kingdoms that were to people it, that were to give it its covering, its adornments, And these adornments of these peoples gradually became the reason for the planet itself. It was their mother. It fed them all. It gave them form and birth, and finally in death received them back again into its own dark earth. Once it is assumed that man was a creature which had a unique destiny bestowed upon it as part of its evolution, then we can begin to understand why man changed the course of nature and little by little gained a strange independence. Man became the only animal that could really worry. There are tendencies now for animals to be neurotic, but it is assumed to be as a result of association with man, which is enough to make anything neurotic. But man certainly is the only animal that knows that it must die. It is the only animal which has ambitions, as we know them. It is the only animal that can pray and hope and argue. It is the only animal that can force its will upon a vast pattern of things by some premeditation, preconception of its own. And it is the only animal that has ever been impelled to ravage the planet. This, however, is not the major purpose of human destiny. In some mysterious way, this body, which we call human, is still unfolding. Having obtained a certain mathematical shape, a certain proportion, the evolution of man produced the body and its changes up to a point. And then apparently the body had completed that which its evolution required of it. The body of man will continue to be modified gradually over vast periods of time. But as far as we can tell, it has remained about the same for a very long time. The body of man has not changed as rapidly in recent times. And evolution has moved from the growth of the body to the growth of the person within the body. Unless the person grows, the evolution of the body is meaningless as far as man is concerned. For the body is now dedicated to the advancement of his purpose. If man needs more from the body in time will provide it. If man demands faculties or powers which he does not at present possess, nature will meet this demand, and body will be modified to produce whatever is needed. But for some time it has appeared that man does not need to make any major renovation in his physical structure. It is also rather obvious that for some time man has not called upon the resources he already possesses. He is not demanding of the body the full measure of its loyalty or its obedience. He is simply acting as a despot, requiring that the body sustain his follies, whatever they may be. For this reason, the body is punished, and its security and survival are endangered. If the person in the body fails the body, then ultimately this entire form will fall back into the chaos from which it came in some remote period of the past. The person in the body, however, continues to grow. We observe, historically, a tremendous unfoldment of man. We notice the rise of arts and sciences, the increase of knowledge. We also perceive in him the unfoldment of his aesthetic sensibilities, his ideals, his dreams, his imagination. Little by little, man has raised himself to the highest level of creativity which he is capable of conceiving. Not too high, perhaps, but the best he can do. So man continues, in one way or another, to reach out from within himself through education, through arts, through religion and philosophy, to gain greater and greater maturity of consciousness, which must come if the purpose for which man was created is to be attained. In the process of his evolution, man also developed a pattern of racial differentiations, very similar to the animal species of other kingdoms, or the types of plants or minerals that we find. Man, however, being a little more self-centered, a little more egotistic than most other creations, no longer considered variety as something gracious and enchanting. He began to think of variety only in terms of competitive excellence. Therefore, instead of recognizing the unfolding of humanity as a magnificent mystery of life, he began to stigmatize the various kinds of his own type. He began to talk about advanced races and backward races. He created a vast conflict in races, simply because he did not realize that racial differentiation in the human kingdom is like the differentiation of birds, or of flowers, or of the bright minerals in the earth. Men treasure some minerals more than others, but the minerals themselves are equal. There is no difference in their value apart from that which we artificially put upon them. Thus, all forms of humanity have meaning, have purpose, and are subjected to laws of evolution. Some have had greater opportunity. Some have been more fortunate in climatic environment, which has a very big bearing upon growth. But all humanity is one living thing, under one archetype. And this archetype is bringing humanity gradually into a maturity of purpose suitable to its destiny. But we are not too sure just where we are in this unfolding cycle of things. But the Oriental peoples especially, the Chinese and the Hindus, consider that humanity has passed the halfway mark in its development. In the course of the involutionary process, life, consciousness, intelligence descended gradually into the organisms which it was to ensoul, which the different qualities were to ensoul. And then, having reached the midway point in growth, the involutionary process tipped into an evolutionary one. That which had gradually been locked into body began to break through body. And little by little, in the evolutionary cycle, man will release into manifestation all of the potentials which were gradually locked into him in the process of quickening a body. The evolutionary trend, therefore, means that man's growth from now on, through the rest of the pattern of humanity, is a continual revelation from within himself of that which is within himself. And this means that much that we know nothing about today must ultimately come forth from him. Today we are a little concerned over things like extrasensory perception. We are beginning to suspect that there are powers in man that have not yet been generally appreciated. We are aware that clairvoyance may exist and not be merely a superstition of old times. That various forms of pre-knowledge and foreknowledge may also exist. That psychometry may be real. That it is quite possible that man has energies which have not yet revealed themselves. That powers to heal his own sickness, powers to overcome his own ignorance, may be locked within him. The Chinese have always believed that sometime man would release through himself the power to educate himself, and that it would not be necessary for him to build vast educational systems. These educational systems are only there to prod the sleeping knowledge in man. Where education itself, from the word educo, means only to draw forth, it does not mean to cram in. So that it's quite possible that there may be a mysterious power by which man can tune into knowledge, just as today is able to twist the dials on a television or a radio and achieve a miracle that his ancestors would have regarded as not the work of God, but the work of the devil with fair cause. In any event, man has more in him than has ever come out. And the process of bringing it out and getting it out is associated with the situation of living. And here we can begin to think in terms of some of the other Eastern moral philosophies concerning man. Buddhism has quite a lot to say about this. Because, after all, its peculiar province was man and the internal structure of his own psychic nature. Obviously, man grows best under pressure of some kind. The individual must be lured out of a kind of complacency which might otherwise reduce his probabilities of survival. All the way down through the kingdoms of nature to the lowest that we can understand, the great pressure to survive has moved all things forward. Survival means always that the individual must be more than he is or perish. That which he is sets up problems for him. The present level of his knowledge at any time causes him to endanger himself. The only solution seems to be that as this danger becomes more immediate and imminent, the human being has to release another level of insight to combat this situation in which he has painted himself into a corner. Each time he uses this insight, he moves forward. Then he rests for a little while and uses his new level of insight to get himself into a further difficulty. This again has to be solved by another exertion of consciousness, so that man grows simply because he wants to survive. He has never grown really from the sheer joy of the prospect. He has never become wise. So much from the fact that he loved wisdom as that he was tired of misery. And out of wisdom he hoped to find a remedy for misery. Thus, something prods us, has prodded us from the beginning, and has forbidden us any security since man was man. At a very early time, when he hardly knew enough to survive, he had already sufficient skill to tie a stone to an axe handle and hit his brother over the head with it. From the oldest days, he was in conflict with his own kind. Ambitions and jealousies began to develop within him. Conspiracy became one of his greatest avocations. He was resolved to conquer the earth as soon as he knew that there was an earth. So little by little, he has complicated his destiny. He has created systems and destroyed them. He has built cities and torn them down. He has made laws and broken them. He has persecuted others and been persecuted in turn. He has become more dangerous with the passing of every year. Until now, his own dangerousness really frightens him almost out of his wits. Man goes on, forever trying to find the answer. So what we call suffering, or what Buddhism calls suffering, is the natural and inevitable consequence of man living contrary to a reasonable code. Suffering arises from breaking the simple rules. Or, as the scriptures would insist, from disobedience. Not disobedience to a personal deity, but disobedience to the general pattern of existence itself. Disobedience to the common sense rules, which have always been, which man has always, to a measure at least, recognized. But because of his own nature, because of his own arrogance, because of his own incredible ambitions and determinations, man has forced his way down through time, almost always destroying something. Against this destruction, he has tried to build certain laws, rules, institutions, the Hague Conferences, the League of Nations, the United Nations Organization. All these represent man's recognition of his own inability to govern himself with dignity. And yet the same old struggle goes on. Buddhism simply takes the attitude that all this is contributing to evolution simply because it is forcing the individual to wake up. That ultimately he will reach a condition in which he must be right or perish. And when that time comes, at least a percentage will choose to be right. This would then carry this mysterious process of growth over the next hurdle which lies in the future. The next point that perhaps is of value in the study of man is the consideration of his destiny. Where is man going? This, of course, depends largely upon the basic thinking. If you're an existentialist, man isn't going very far. If you are a humanist, he may not make it even as far as the existentialist. If you're a Christian humanist, you have a slight confusion in your mind, but you have greater hopes. Actually, where man is going depends very largely upon trying to decide in your own mind whether anything is going anywhere. If you want to assume when you look out of a window that there is nothing there except accident, incident, circumstance, conditions that have no rational foundation in anything, that the universe simply exists, and it does not know why itself and never will discover, that there was nothing that fashioned it, it has always been, or if it hasn't always been, it arose by some spontaneous process within itself. For a long time, science had the delightful hypothesis that the universe is the only machine in the world that could manufacture itself in the first place. This was considered scientific. We rather doubt that at the moment. We also have to say, is man going anywhere? Is there any relationship between modern man and ancient man? Are the Greeks and the Romans gone forever? If so, what good were the Greeks and Romans? Tourist agencies will tell us they left some splendid ruins which have been exploited with considerable profit by travel agencies. But what of the experience of the Greeks and Romans? Do we know really anything about it? Did they ever leave any adequate histories? Did they ever tell the truth about themselves, and did anyone else ever tell the truth about them? We do not know. We know that in some mysterious way, the mistakes of the Greeks and Romans linger on. What about the tremendous but dismal periods of the Dark Ages? Here man went through some of the most extraordinary examples of self-delusion that have ever been recorded. Here men frightened themselves to death. Witchcraft, demonology. The individual living in a universe of terrors, believing in a good God and finding nothing good anywhere. Then he went out to save the world by the Crusades. The Crusades were probably the greatest disaster in Western history. Nothing happened. And while the Crusaders were out trying to save the Holy Land, the four F's who remained behind took over Europe. This was perhaps the way it should have been, but it was not exactly inspiring. What about all this? Does it mean anything? What about the magnificent cultures of China and India of ancient times? The caves of Ellora and Elephanta? The wonderful sculpturings of Sarnath and Benares? The beautiful monuments of the Mughal Empire? What are all these things? Do they mean anything? The builders of them are gone. Is man only able to leave behind him monuments to his own dead? Are the builders of these things gone forever? And will we, who now stand in wonder of these monuments, join the forever dead in our own turn? This is something that somewhere along the line, Western man is going to have to solve. Because if he doesn't solve it, he's going to end in the most complete neurosis. The individual simply can't live with absolute nihilism. He cannot build anything if there is nothing to build with and nothing to survive after it is built. Man today is gravely concerned with not only where he is going, but if he is going. And yet, it would seem a very tragic thing indeed if this wonderful generation should perish completely. We're not so sure we like this generation in every way. But you realize that 100 years from now, there will probably be not a handful of human beings alive who are alive today. Everything will have gone. New generations will take over. The process is so gradual we hardly notice it. But it is inevitable and eternal. And so, if evolution is going to take place, how does it operate? Biologically? Are we to assume that in some mysterious way all the growth we have achieved goes on in the cell? And then some way or other, the future is enriched by the fact that we have existed. The future doesn't know this any more than we know how much we were enriched for the past. But is it all there? And if so, is there sufficient justification in this? Is it perfectly all right that everything shall perish, only that the genes can go on? It doesn't sound economical. It doesn't sound especially reasonable, but it is frightfully scientific. In fact, it is frightful. But we have no way to refute the scientist in his own language. We can only profoundly suspect that he is short-sighted. In this way, let us then take the possibility, which also belong to our ancient brethren, that this life moving down through time is one life. That humanity is one way of life. That which is actually growing is like the flowing of a river. That life is moving from its source to its final state as one vast organism. That this motion is real. That this motion is purposeful. That these things happen because it is best that they happen. And that some force, power, or plan that we do not understand has decreed that the only way in which the particular purpose now at hand can be accomplished is the way it is being accomplished. And that therefore this way is indeed the beautiful necessity. It is the thing as it should be, as it must be. Man can only hope, however, to try to fathom something of the mystery of it, to find out how to explain his place in this project. Buddha was very suspicious that man would ever be able to know, as a mental fact, the truth about himself. Buddha realized that the mind is the slayer of the real, that the mind locks us in attitudes, but that this is strange but true, that the mind is a blind man that thinks it can see. The mind has created in its own darkness a kind of inner sight, a sight which is simply devoted to seeing what is expected, what is required, what is assumed to be true. The mind is locked within the kind of a pattern that produces college professors, intelligentsia, and historians generally, and produces the endless perpetuation of policies that are defended long after their vitality is exhausted. The mind just keeps on thinking in the same old way. And the individual can outgrow his own mind. He can be more honest than his religion. He can be more enlightened than his education. And he can be more scientific than his sciences. Because these are heavy things, moving slowly. But man moves more rapidly and anticipates in himself the courses which institutions will follow in ages to come. So we have the possibility that man has other ways of finding out the facts. If man wants to know about himself in the Buddhist philosophy, the only answer is to disentangle his mind from its attachments to all the preconceptions, restrictions, and limitations imposed by tradition and the common observation of things around him. This does not mean that the individual is to allow his mind to wander about like an unbroken colt in a pasture. But it does take the ground that the deepest part of human knowledge, that part of the individual which can come the nearest to knowing, is something very silent, very abstract within the core of man's own being. The only way the individual can hope to know is through inner experience. The only solution lies in an unconditioned intuition. Not an intuition that is waiting to see a certain thing. Not an intuition that decides beforehand what it is going to discover. Not an intuition that is going to censor its own processes by conventional rules. Not an intuition that would be afraid of idealism or afraid of realism. But an intuition receptive to whatever is actually there.